So the story is told of a woman who looked out a window and saw her German shepherd shaking the life out of the neighbor's rabbit. Her family did not get along very well with these neighbors, so this was obviously going to be an unmitigated, terrible disaster. She grabbed the broom, went outside, and pummeled her dog until he dropped the now extremely dead rabbit on the ground. She panicked, didn't know what to do, so she grabbed the rabbit, took it inside, gave it a bath, blow-dried it to its original fluffiness, combed it until that rabbit looked pretty good. Then she snuck into her neighbor's yard and propped the rabbit back up in its cage. An hour later, she heard screams coming from next door. She called out to her neighbor, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" "Our rabbit," she said. "Our rabbit," the neighbor cried. "He died 3 days ago. We buried him, and now he's back." I'm not sure that that's a true story, but it's a good one. So we're in this series called Stranger Things, and actually, we're in this series at The Crossing, just like you guys are in this series, because Don and I both thought, what a great idea, let's do that together. And as you've already figured out now, we're not talking about the insanely popular Netflix show. This is just a great title for talking about the real-life encounters with the supernatural Jesus. And, you know, Scripture is just filled with encounters with Christ that where Jesus did and said and was things that surprised people and showed that he was God. And, of course, the main part of the story started 2 weeks ago when we celebrated Jesus' resurrection. You know, his death and burial and resurrection, that's kind of where it all starts. And Jesus was dead and buried, and then he came back, and when he did, his followers had pretty much the same response as the rabbit lady. They did, because when he came back, there was some screams, there was definitely some shock and some disbelief, and they didn't know, okay, is this really Jesus? Because they were not expecting that. And so, what I'd like to do this morning is kind of take a little closer look at part of that story and look at some of the stranger things that have happened. I want to start with the story of Thomas. You may know him as Doubting Thomas. If you have a Bible, go ahead and turn to John chapter 20. We're going to be in verses 19 through 29. John chapter 20. We'll also have the verses up here on screen, assuming that I sent them correctly to Linda. John chapter 20, verses 19 through 29. Before we get in there, let me kind of paint the picture for you of what's going on here. It is Sunday evening. Okay, Jesus was crucified 2 days earlier on Friday. Jesus was arrested, he was tortured, crucified. His followers saw that. His Roman executioners had certified that Jesus was dead. His body was wrapped in a burial shroud, and he was placed in a tomb that was carved into the hillside. And they rolled this two-ton stone in front of the entrance. Okay, that was Friday. Now it's Sunday night. Jesus' followers, upon his crucifixion, they scattered. They fled for their lives in fear. Some of them were hiding. All of them were devastated. And stop and think about this for a minute. Imagine losing someone that you deeply love. Whether that's a friend or a family member. Can you just begin to imagine the shock and the mind-numbing disbelief and the emptiness? And now layer on top of that, the fact that you placed your hopes and dreams in this person. You believe that he was sent by God, and not just sent by God, but that he actually was God. And yet, now somehow he's dead. How is that possible? I mean, put yourself in the mind of those disciples. Friday night, Jesus crucified, it's Sunday night now. How is it possible that Jesus is dead? Okay, the only explanation I can think of is that he wasn't who he claimed to be, right? I mean, the guy said this and now he's dead. I guess he wasn't. And so for the past 2 days, this has been your state of mind. It's Sunday night. But this morning, something very strange occurred. John chapter 20, let me just start up in verse 1. It says, early on Sunday morning, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and found that the stone had been rolled away from the entrance. She ran and found Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, that's John. She said, they've taken the Lord's body out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him. Because here comes Mary, and she says, the tomb's been broken into, and Jesus' body is missing. A little bit later, Mary and a couple other women claim that Jesus has actually risen from the dead. But you, remember, your disciples, you're gathered together at Sunday night, you haven't seen Jesus, so are you buying the story that Jesus is alive? Probably not. You know, you got some women who went to the tomb and they say he's alive. You go, oh yeah, right. As if you could really do that. And you can tell that the disciples didn't believe from the way they acted. Here's John chapter 20, verse 19. It says, that Sunday evening, the disciples were meeting behind locked doors because they were afraid of the Jewish leaders. So the disciples are afraid for their lives, and so they're holed up in a room somewhere in some obscure corner of Jerusalem, probably. The doors are barred. They're being so very careful. They're talking only in whispers, if they're talking at all, because they think they're about to die. Keep reading. Suddenly, Jesus was standing among them. Peace be with you, he said. Why did Jesus say peace be with you? Because everyone in the room simultaneously wet their pants. They did. They were not expecting this. All of a sudden, Jesus is there and he says, peace be with them. They're like, ah! What a strange thing. Luke, I love Luke because he gives us a little bit more detail than John. Luke chapter 24, verse 36 says, Jesus himself was suddenly standing there among them. Peace be with you, he said. But the whole group was startled and frightened, thinking they were seeing a ghost. Why are you frightened? He asked. Why are your hearts filled with doubt? Look. Look at my hands. Look at my feet. You can see that it's really me. Touch me. Make sure that I'm not a ghost, because ghosts don't have bodies, as everybody knows. Ghosts don't have bodies like you and I do. And as he spoke, he showed them his hands and his feet. Still, they stood there in disbelief. I mean, what's he going to do to prove to them? He said, I'm not a ghost. And they're just all staring at him. They were filled, since they were disbelief, filled with joy and wonder. And he asked them, and I imagine he had a big sigh, goes, okay, do you have anything to eat? Because everybody knows ghosts can't eat, or if they can't, you would see it go right there. Right? And so they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he ate it as they watched. They still don't believe him. He's got this piece of food. He puts it in, and they watch him. They're all watching him. He puts it in his mouth, and he swallows it. To the very last instant, they are not going to believe that it's really Jesus alive. And who can blame him? Because would you have believed it? I don't think so. You'd think there's got to be some explanation. I don't know what it is. You know, maybe it's a holograph, like Obi-Wan Kenobi had in Star Wars or something. You know, I don't think that we understand the depth of the despair and the hopelessness that Jesus' followers experienced after his death. I mean, we jump from Friday to Sunday to he's alive. And then we don't think about Saturday. It is very clear that they were not expecting anything except that they were next to be killed. That's what they were. They thought Jesus is dead, and now they're coming for us. So head for the hills, hide in rooms, lock the doors, talk in whispers. And you know, by the way, this is one of the strongest arguments that Jesus really did rise from the dead. Because how else can you explain a group of despondent, defeated disciples who are paralyzed with grief? And yet, 6 months later, a year later, they go on to become this bold, unstoppable force that changes the world? Are you kidding me? Something happened. Now, some people people have claimed that, that the disciples fabricated the resurrection story. You know, that when they were in that room with the doors locked, not knowing what to do, they kind of regrouped and they channeled their grief and their broken dreams into a vision to spread. I know, let's spread Jesus' teachings because they were so good. And then, you know, it really helped us, this cause, if he rose from the dead. So let's say that Jesus rose from the dead, and that'll add credibility to the message. Now, that might sound okay on the face of it, but let's think about this really for a second. First of all, at the core of Jesus' teaching is truth. Let's just start with that. Is truth and authenticity. Why was he always reaming out the Pharisees? It's because they were hypocrites. Truth and authenticity and genuine relationship with God. He's saying it's your hearts that matter. How in the world can you spread Jesus' teaching knowing that it's based on a lie? Okay, that's the first. Second, Jesus claimed this in John 11, 35. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even after he dies. Now, if Jesus can't do that for himself, how in the world could anyone expect him to do it for them? I don't think it's possible. Here's the third thing. Jesus claimed to be the Jewish Messiah. He claimed that he was the Messiah, the Son of God, the Anointed One. I am he. I am the one you've been waiting for. New Testament scholar N.T. Wright has written about what that meant. We don't understand the concept of Messiah. We don't quite get what they were thinking when they thought Messiah. A first century Jew, Wright says, believed that the Messiah would bring God's kingdom down to earth in three very specific ways. They said, when the Messiah comes, these three things are happening. Number one, the Messiah will liberate the Jewish nation from Rome. Okay? Liberate the Jewish nation from Rome. Number two, the Messiah will reestablish God's kingdom on earth through the Jewish nation and the temple. Okay, he's going to reestablish God's kingdom. And number three, the Messiah will end evil, injustice, pain, and death. That's what the Messiah will do. Therefore, any so-called Messiah who was crucified, killed, was immediately understood to be a false one, because if you're dead, you ain't him. And there were others who claimed to be messiahs, but if you died, automatically they knew you weren't the guy, because you couldn't do that. This is what he writes, and I'll quote him here. There were many messianic movements in the first century. Often the would-be messiah got crucified by Rome, as Jesus did. But in not one single case do we hear the slightest mention of the disappointed followers claiming their hero had been raised from the dead. They knew better. Take all that and then put on top of the fact that 10 of those 11 disciples were executed, murdered for their faith, many of them tortured first, and yet not even one of them changed their story. To their dying breath, they claimed, no, Jesus rose from the dead. Even though you're going to kill me now, yes, I will sacrifice my life for this truth. Something happened. Now let's keep reading. John 20, verse 24, it says, one of the 12 disciples, here's Thomas, nicknamed the twin, was not with the others when Jesus came. They told him, we have seen the Lord. But he replied, I won't believe it unless I see the nail wounds in his hands, put my fingers into them, and place my hand into the wound on his side. You know, I don't think the term, we call him doubting Thomas, I don't think that term really captures it. Thomas did not doubt the resurrection. He flat out rejected it. There was no doubt in his mind at all, was there? It's like, I don't think so. If you stand right in front of me, that's the day I'll believe it. Now, to be fair, none of the other guys believed it until Jesus showed up either, right? And even when Jesus showed up, they didn't believe it. He had a piece of fish. So who can blame Thomas here? Who would have believed? Would you have believed? Probably not. You know, really, Thomas has gotten kind of a bad rap because, again, all we know about is his moniker, Doubting Thomas. He actually wasn't a doubter at all. He was a man of passion and conviction. There's a really fascinating account in John chapter 11. Jesus was in trouble with the religious leaders, as he often was. And this time he was really in trouble. They were planning to kill him. Okay, and they're in Jerusalem. They're plotting to kill him. They want to take Jesus out. And so Jesus one day says to his disciples, hey, let's go back to Jerusalem, you know, where they're planning to kill me. Let's go back there. And the disciples say, are you kidding, Jesus? They're trying to kill you. Bad idea. No, don't go to Jerusalem. Don't do it. But Jesus insists, no, I'm going to Jerusalem. You want to come with me? All right. And you know what Thomas says at that point? This is John 11:16. Thomas, nicknamed the twin. I'm not sure why they always put that in there, but his nickname is the twin. Said to his fellow disciples, let's go to and die with Jesus. Jesus is going to go die. Let's go with him. We'll die with him too. Okay, so this guy, Thomas, he is all in. Isn't he? I mean, he's in. He is no doubter. He's ready to follow Jesus to his death. And I think what was going on is that Thomas loved Jesus so much, and Thomas was so consumed with Jesus' vision for the kingdom of God and for his love and his healing and his forgiveness. He had given himself so fully to Christ that when Jesus died, Thomas was utterly ruined. I mean, it took him out. He's got a broken heart. And when his other yahoos dare raise any hope, he's got to protect himself because he doesn't even dare to hope because he has a broken heart. You've seen Jesus, have you? Well, I won't believe until I see him for myself. No way am I opening up my heart to him again. And you know, I wonder if that isn't what keeps us from seeing Jesus. You know, we get hurt. We get disappointed. We get disillusioned. Often. It's part of life. And instead of running to Jesus, we run away from him. We close ourselves off because we want to hang on to control. It's like, okay, I'm gonna circle the wagons and hang on to control, and it's just gonna be me. But that can be dangerous. C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite authors, this is what he writes. He says, to love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable. Especially to love God is to be vulnerable, to open yourself up. And I wonder if because of whatever hurt disillusionment or bump or wall that you've hit. I wonder if sometimes we close ourselves off. Alright, verse 26. 8 days later, the disciples were together again, and this time Thomas was with them. The doors were locked. Alright, let me interrupt myself here. Question. Why are the doors still locked? Locked. This is 8 days after Jesus has already appeared to these guys. The doors are locked. Jesus is alive. These disciples, they should be out on the street handing out tracts or something. I don't know what. Obviously, they still don't quite believe it, do they? He appeared to them a week ago. It's 8 days later. Doors are locked. They're still talking in whispers. Or maybe they don't know what to do with it. Or maybe Thomas got to them. Maybe he said, you know, you guys had too much pizza or something. So it never really happened. Maybe they're doubting with him. Anyway, so the doors were locked, but suddenly, as before, Jesus was standing among them. Peace be with you, he said. And they all jumped, but not quite as high as before, except for Thomas, of course, who is as white as a sheet, and his mouth is open, and he's staring at Jesus. Then Jesus said to Thomas, put your finger here. Look at my hands. Put your hand into the wound of my side. Don't be faithless any longer. Believe. My Lord and my God, Thomas exclaimed. And Jesus told him, you believe because you've seen me. Blessed are those who believe without seeing me. Now, I noticed something about Jesus' interaction there with Thomas. Notice that Jesus isn't angry. He doesn't scold. Instead, he appears and invites. He just appears and invites. He shows up when he knows Thomas is going to be there. And he invites Thomas to believe. Here I am, Tom. Touch my hand. Believe. Follow me. Get back in. And Thomas does. Matter of fact, Thomas is the first person after the resurrection to call Jesus God. My Lord and my God. And he falls to his feet and worships him. And out of Thomas's crisis of faith comes a confession of faith. And Thomas goes on to be a great missionary. There's strong evidence that eventually Thomas traveled to India, where he leads many people to Christ and starts churches. Matter of fact, I found out that when the Portuguese first landed in India in the early 1600s, they found a group of Christians there already who have Thomas's name. It's called the Mar Thoma Church. Here's a picture. I think. Oh, it's not there. Oh, we didn't get the picture. Anyway, there's a picture I have from India of the Mar Thoma Church, which continues to this day. A millennium and a half after Thomas, it's still there. The last thing that Jesus says to Thomas is that we are blessed if we believe without seeing him. He says, blessed are you because you see me. Blessed are those who believe without having seen me. That's us. Jesus says, you know what? We are blessed if we believe that he rose from the dead, even though we weren't there to experience it like Thomas was. So what does it mean to believe without seeing? Jesus says, blessed are those who believe without seeing. Well, I'll tell you what it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean blind faith. It doesn't mean believing with no evidence. You know, like, I don't know what movie, faith is believing something when common sense tells you not to. It's not blind faith, believing without any evidence. It's also not dogmatic faith, like believe with no question, just believe because I told you so. Don't question anything. That's not what it means to believe without seeing. To believe without seeing is to respond to the evidence while still acknowledging that you don't have all the answers. Okay, to believe without seeing is to say there's evidence here. I see this. I don't know all the answers. I don't know how it all works out. I still have some questions. But I see the evidence. And I believe. And by the way, there is good evidence. There are good reasons to believe that Jesus Christ really did rise from the dead. One of which I mentioned earlier. The radically transformed lives of his disciples and his followers. To believe without seeing is to weigh the evidence and then choose to believe because of the evidence. And then to surrender, like Thomas, to surrender your whole life to Christ, my Lord and my God. Jesus still appears and invites. He doesn't appear the way he did to Thomas, but he is here right now. He appears in our lives, and he's continually inviting us to know him. Continually inviting us to trust him with our hearts and our disillusions and our discouragements and our walls and our bumps and our wounds and our lives. He's continually inviting us. Trust me with this. Step toward me. Believe, even though you haven't seen me, and give yourself to me. So in what way this morning are you like Thomas?
way this morning might Christ be inviting you to step toward him in belief? In what way is he calling you to surrender yourself to him? To take a step of faith? And say, I don't have all the questions answered, but the evidence is here and I'm going to believe this. Why don't you bow your heads? Let's just reflect on this for a moment. How do you need to respond to this message this morning? How is the Spirit of God inviting you to step closer to him? Would you whisper a prayer right now in that direction and say, God, I choose to trust you, or God, I surrender myself to you. Or God, I've been holding on to this hurt or this wound or this disappointment, and I now turn towards you and release it to you. Father, we all need, we all long for your presence in our lives. And we need your grace, and we need your forgiveness. And Lord, I thank you that you always act toward us like you did toward Thomas. Jesus, you didn't scold him, you just invited him to stop being faithless and step toward me. And I pray that you give us the courage to step toward you in the ways that we need to today. And then Lord, I ask that you will use us like you used Thomas. That you will use us to help people know you and experience your life just as we have.